Chapter 4 Independence Verse 1 The Siddhis, or powers, are attained by birth, chemical means, power of words, mortification, or concentration. Sometimes a man is born with the Siddhis, powers, of course, those he had earned in his previous incarnation. This time he is born, as it were, to enjoy the fruits of them. It is said of Kapila, the great father of the Samkhya philosophy, that he was a born Siddha, which means literally a man who has attained to success. The yogis claim that these powers can be gained by chemical means. All of you know that chemistry originally began as alchemy. Men went in search of the philosopher's stone and elixirs of life and so forth. In India, there was a sect called the Rasayanas. Their idea was that ideality, knowledge, spirituality, and religion were all very right, but that the body was the only instrument by which to attain to all these. If the body came to an end every now and again, it would take so much more time to attain to the goal. For instance, a man wants to practice yoga or wants to become spiritual. Before he has advanced very far, he dies. Then he takes another body and begins again, then dies, and so on. In this way, much time will be lost in dying and being born again. If the body could be made strong and perfect, so that it would get rid of birth and death, we should have so much more time to become spiritual. So these Rasayanas say, first make the body very strong. They claim that this body can be made immortal. Their idea is that if the mind manufactures the body, and if it be true that each mind is only one outlet to the infinite energy, there should be no limit to each outlet getting any amount of power from outside. Why is it impossible to keep our bodies all the time? We have to manufacture all the bodies that we ever have. As soon as this body dies, we shall have to manufacture another. If we can do that, why cannot we do it just here and now, without getting out of the present body? The theory is perfectly correct. If it is possible that we live after death and make other bodies, why is it impossible that we should have the power of making bodies here, without entirely dissolving this body, simply changing it continually? They also thought that in mercury and in sulfur was hidden the most wonderful power, and that by certain preparations of these, a man could keep the body as long as he liked. Others believed that certain drugs could bring powers, such as flying through the air. Many of the most wonderful medicines of the present day we owe to the Rasayanas, notably the use of metals in medicine. Certain sects of yogis claim that many of their principal teachers are still living in their old bodies. Patanjali, the great authority on yoga, does not deny this. The power of words. There are certain sacred words called mantras which have power, when repeated under proper conditions, to produce these extraordinary powers. We are living in the midst of such a mass of miracles, day and night, that we do not think anything of them. There is no limit to man's power, the power of words and the power of mind. Mortification. You find that in every religion, mortifications and asceticisms have been practiced. In these religious conceptions, the Hindus always go to the extremes. You will find men with their hands up all their lives, until their hands wither and die. Men keep standing day and night until their feet swell, and if they live, the legs become so stiff in this position that they can no more bend them, but have to stand all their lives. I once saw a man who had kept his hands raised in this way, and I asked him how it felt when he did it first. He said it was awful torture. It was such torture that he had to go to a river and put himself in water, and that allayed the pain for a little while. After a month, he did not suffer much. Through such practices, powers, or siddhis, can be attained. Concentration. Concentration is samadhi, and that is yoga proper. That is the principal theme of this science, and it is the highest means. The preceding ones are only secondary, and we cannot attain to the highest through them. Samadhi is the means through which we can gain anything and everything, mental, moral, or spiritual. Verse 2. The change into another species is by the filling in of nature. Patanjali has advanced the proposition that these powers come by birth, sometimes by chemical means, or through mortification. He also admits that this body can be kept for any length of time. Now he goes on to state what is the cause of the change of the body into another species. He says this is done by the filling in of nature, which he explains in the next aphorism. Verse 3. Good and bad deeds are not the direct causes in the transformations of nature, but they act as breakers of obstacles to the evolutions of nature, as a farmer breaks the obstacles to the course of water, which then runs down by its own nature. The water for irrigation of fields is already in the canal, only shut in by gates. The farmer opens these gates, and the water flows in by itself, by the law of gravitation. So all progress and power are already in every man. Perfection is man's nature, only it is barred in and prevented from taking its proper course. If anyone can take the bar off, in rushes nature. Then the man attains the powers which are his already. Those we call wicked become saints as soon as the bar is broken and nature rushes in. It is nature that is driving us towards perfection, and eventually she will bring everyone there. All these practices and struggles to become religious are only negative work to take off the bars and open the doors to that perfection which is our birthright, our nature. Today, the evolution theory of the ancient yogis will be better understood in the light of modern research. And yet, the theory of the yogis is a better explanation. The two causes of evolution advanced by the moderns, that is, sexual selection and survival of the fittest, are inadequate. Suppose human knowledge to have advanced so much as to eliminate competition, both from the function of acquiring physical sustenance and of acquiring a mate. Then, according to the moderns, human progress will stop and the race will die. The result of this theory is to furnish every oppressor with an argument to calm the qualms of conscience. Men are not lacking who, posing as philosophers, want to kill out all wicked and incompetent persons. They are, of course, the only judges of competency, and thus preserve the human race. But the great ancient evolutionist, Patanjali, declares that the true secret of evolution is the manifestation of the perfection which is already in every being. That this perfection has been barred and the infinite tide behind is struggling to express itself. These struggles and competitions are but the results of our ignorance, because we do not know the proper way to unlock the gate and let the water in, this infinite tide behind must express itself. It is the cause of all manifestation. Competitions for life or sex gratification are only momentary, unnecessary, extraneous effects caused by ignorance. Even when all competition has ceased, this perfect nature behind will make us go forward until everyone has become perfect. Therefore, there is no reason to believe that competition is necessary to progress. In the animal, the man was suppressed, but as soon as the door was opened, out rushed man. So in man, there is the potential God, kept in by the locks and bars of ignorance. When knowledge breaks these bars, the God becomes manifest. Verse 4. From egoism alone proceed the created minds. The theory of karma is that we suffer for our good or bad deeds, and the whole scope of philosophy is to reach the glory of man. All the scriptures sing the glory of man, of the soul, and then, in the same breath, they preach karma. A good deed brings such a result, and a bad deed such another. But if the soul can be acted upon by a good or a bad deed, the soul amounts to nothing. Bad deeds put a bar to the manifestation of the nature of the Purusha. Good deeds take the obstacles off, and the glory of the Purusha becomes manifest. The Purusha itself is never changed. Whatever you do never destroys your own glory, your own nature, because the soul cannot be acted upon by anything. Only a veil is spread before it, hiding its perfection. With a view to exhausting their karma quickly, yogis create kaya vyuha, or groups of bodies, in which to work it out. For all these bodies, they create minds from egoism. These are called created minds, in contradistinction to their original minds. Verse 5. Though the activities of the different created minds are various, the one original mind is the controller of them all. These different minds, which act in these different bodies, are called made minds, and the bodies, made bodies, that is, manufactured bodies and minds. Matter and mind are like two inexhaustible storehouses. When you become a yogi, you learn the secret of their control. It was yours all the time, but you had forgotten it. When you become a yogi, you recollect it. Then you can do anything with it, manipulate it in every way you like. The material out of which a manufactured mind is created is the very same material which is used for the macrocosm. It is not that mind is one thing and matter another. They are different aspects of the same thing. Asmita, or egoism, is the material, the fine state of existence out of which these made minds and made bodies of the yogi are manufactured. Therefore, when the yogi has found the secret of these energies of nature, he can manufacture any number of bodies or minds out of the substance known as egoism. Verse 6. Among the various chittas, that which is attained by samadhi is desireless. Among all the various minds that we see in various men, only that mind which has attained to samadhi, perfect concentration, is the highest. A man who has attained certain powers through medicines, or through words, or through mortifications, still has desires. But that man who has attained to samadhi through concentration is alone free from all desires. Verse 7. Works are neither black nor white for the yogis. For others, they are threefold, black, white, and mixed. When the yogi has attained perfection, his actions and the karma produced by these actions do not bind him because he did not desire them. He just works on. He works to do good, and he does good, but does not care for the result, and it will not come to him. But for ordinary men, we have not attained to that highest state. Works are of three kinds: black, for evil actions; white, for good actions; and mixed. Verse 8. From these threefold works are manifested in each state only those desires which are fitting to that state alone. The others are held in abeyance for the time being. Suppose I have made the three kinds of karma, good, bad, and mixed, and suppose I die and become a god in heaven. The desires in a god body are not the same as the desires in a human body. The god body neither eats nor drinks. What becomes of my past unworked karmas which produce as their effect the desire to eat and drink? Where would these karmas go when I become a god? The answer is that desires can only manifest themselves in proper environments. Only those desires will come out for which the environment is fitted. The rest will remain stored up. In this life, we have many godly desires, many human desires, many animal desires. If I take a god body, only the good desires will come up, because for them the environments are suitable. And if I take an animal body, only the animal desires will come up, and the good desires will wait. What does this show? That by means of environment, we can check these desires. Only that karma which is suited to and fitted for the environments will come out. This shows that the power of environment is the great check to control even karma itself. Verse 9. There is consecutiveness in desires, even though separated by species, space, and time, there being identification of memory and impressions. Experiences becoming fine become impressions. Impressions revivified become memory. The word memory here includes unconscious coordination of past experiences reduced to impressions with present conscious action. In each body, the group of impressions acquired in a similar body only becomes the cause of action in that body. The experiences of a dissimilar body are held in abeyance. Each body acts as if it were a descendant of a series of bodies of that species only. Thus, consecutiveness of desires is not to be broken. Verse 10. Thirst for happiness being eternal, desires are without beginning. All experience is preceded by desire for happiness. There was no beginning of experience, as each fresh experience is built upon the tendency generated by past experience. Therefore, desire is without beginning. Verse 11. Being held together by cause, effect, support, and objects, in the absence of these is its absence. Desires are held together by cause and effect. If a desire has been raised, it does not die without producing its effect. Then again, the mind stuff is the great storehouse, the support of all past desires reduced to samskara form. Until they have worked themselves out, they will not die. Moreover, so long as the senses receive the external objects, fresh desires will arise. If it be possible to get rid of the cause, effect, support, and objects of desire, then alone it will vanish. Verse 12. The past and future exist in their own nature, qualities having different ways. The idea is that existence never comes out of non-existence. The past and future, though not existing in a manifested form, yet exist in a fine form. Verse 13. They are manifested, or fine, being of the nature of the gunas. The gunas are the three substances, sattva, rajas, and tamas, whose gross state is the sensible universe. Past and future arise from the different modes of manifestation of these gunas. Verse 14. The unity in things is from the unity in changes. Though there are three substances, their changes being coordinated, all objects have their unity. Verse 15. Since perception and desire vary with regard to the same object, mind and object are of different nature. That is, there is an objective world independent of our minds. This is a refutation of Buddhistic idealism. Since different people look at the same thing differently, it cannot be a mere imagination of any particular individual. Verse 16. Things are known or unknown to the mind, being dependent on the coloring which they give to the mind. Verse 17. The states of the mind are always known because the Lord of the mind, the Purusha, is unchangeable. The whole gist of this theory is that the universe is both mental and material. Both of these are in a continuous state of flux. What is this book? It is a combination of molecules in constant change. One lot is going out and another coming in. It is a whirlpool. But what makes the unity? What makes it the same book? The changes are rhythmical. In harmonious order, they are sending impressions to my mind. And these pieced together make a continuous picture, although the parts are continuously changing. Mind itself is continuously changing. The mind and body are like two layers in the same substance, moving at different rates of speed. Relatively, one being slower and the other quicker, we can distinguish between the two motions. For instance, a train is in motion and a carriage is moving alongside it. It is possible to find the motion of both of these to a certain extent, but still, something else is necessary. Motion can only be perceived when there is something else which is not moving. But when two or three things are relatively moving, we first perceive the motion of the faster one, and then that of the slower ones. How is the mind to perceive? It is also in a flux. Therefore, another thing is necessary which moves more slowly. Then you must get to something in which the motion is still slower, and so on, and you will find no end. Therefore, logic compels you to stop somewhere. You must complete the series by knowing something which never changes. Behind this never-ending chain of motion is the Purusha, the changeless, the colorless, the pure. All these impressions are merely reflected upon it, as a magic lantern throws images upon a screen without in any way tarnishing it. Verse 18. The mind is not self-luminous, being an object. Tremendous power is manifested everywhere in nature, but it is not self-luminous, not essentially intelligent. The Purusha alone is self-luminous and gives its light to everything. It is the power of the Purusha that is percolating through all matter and force. Verse 19. From its being unable to cognize both at the same time. If the mind were self-luminous, it would be able to cognize itself and its objects at the same time, which it cannot. When it cognizes the object, it cannot reflect on itself. Therefore, the Purusha is self-luminous and the mind is not. Verse 20. Another cognizing mind being assumed, there will be no end to such assumptions, and confusion of memory will be the result. Let us suppose there is another mind which cognizes the ordinary mind. Then there will have to be still another to cognize the former, and so there will be no end to it. It will result in confusion of memory. There will be no storehouse of memory. Verse 21. The essence of knowledge, the Purusha, being unchangeable, when the mind takes its form, it becomes conscious. Patanjali says this to make it more clear that knowledge is not a quality of the Purusha. When the mind comes near the Purusha, it is reflected, as it were, upon the mind, and the mind, for the time being, becomes knowing and seems as if it were itself the Purusha. Verse 22. Colored by the seer and the seen, the mind is able to understand everything. On one side of the mind, the external world, the seen, is being reflected, and on the other, the seer is being reflected. Thus comes the power of all knowledge to the mind. Verse 23. The mind, though variegated by innumerable desires, acts for another, the Purusha, because it acts in combination. The mind is a compound of various things, and therefore it cannot work for itself. Everything that is a combination in this world has some object for that combination, some third thing for which this combination is going on. So, this combination of the mind is for the Purusha. Verse 24. For the discriminating, the perception of the mind as Atman ceases. Through discrimination, the yogi knows that the Purusha is not mind. Verse 25. Then, bent on discriminating, the mind attains the previous state of kaivalya, isolation or perfection. Thus, the practice of yoga leads to discriminating power, to clearness of vision. The veil drops from the eyes and we see things as they are. We find that nature is a compound and is showing the panorama for the Purusha, who is the witness. That nature is not the Lord, that all the combinations of nature are simply for the sake of showing these phenomena to the Purusha, the enthroned king within. When discrimination comes by long practice, fear ceases and the mind attains isolation or perfection. Verse 26. The thoughts that arise as obstructions to that are from impressions. All the various ideas that arise, making us believe that we require something external to make us happy, are obstructions to that perfection. The Purusha is happiness and blessedness by its own nature. But that knowledge is covered over by past impressions. These impressions have to work themselves out. Verse Verse 27. Their destruction is in the same manner as of ignorance, egoism, etc., as said before in chapter 2, verse 10. Verse 28. Even when arriving at the right discriminating knowledge of the essences, he who gives up the fruits, unto him comes, as the result of perfect discrimination, the samadhi called the cloud of virtue. When the yogi has attained to this discrimination, all the powers mentioned in the last chapter come to him, but the true yogi rejects them all. Unto him comes a peculiar knowledge, a particular light called the Dharma Megha, the cloud of virtue. All the great prophets of the world, whom history has recorded, had this. They had found the whole foundation of knowledge within themselves. Truth to them had become real. Peace and calmness and perfect purity became their own nature after they had given up the vanities of powers. Verse 29. From that comes cessation of pain and works. When that cloud of virtue has come, then no more is there fear of falling. Nothing can drag the yogi down. No more will there be evils for him. No more pains. Verse 30. Then knowledge, bereft of covering and impurities, becoming infinite, the knowable becomes small. Knowledge itself is there. Its covering is gone. One of the Buddhistic scriptures defines what is meant by the Buddha, which is the name of a state, as infinite knowledge, infinite as the sky. Jesus attained to that and became the Christ. All of you will attain to that state. Knowledge becoming infinite, the knowable becomes small. The whole universe, with all its objects of knowledge, becomes as nothing before the Purusha. The ordinary man thinks himself very small, because to him the knowable seems to be infinite. Verse 31. Then are finished the successive transformations of the qualities, they having attained the end. Then all these various transformations of the qualities, which change from species to species, cease forever. Verse 32. The changes that exist in relation to moments, and which are perceived at the other end, at the end of a series, are succession. Patanjali here defines the word succession, the changes that exist in relation to moments. While I think, many moments pass, and with each moment there is a change of idea, but I only perceive these changes at the end of a series. This is called succession, but for the mind that has realized omnipresence, there is no succession. Everything has become present for it. To it, the present alone exists. The past and future are lost. Time stands controlled. All knowledge is there in 1 second. Everything is known like a flash. Verse 33. The resolution in the inverse order of the qualities, bereft of any motive of action for the Purusha, is Kaivalya, or it is the establishment of the power of knowledge in its own nature. Nature's task is done. This unselfish task, which our sweet nurse, nature, had imposed upon herself. She gently took the self-forgetting soul by the hand, as it were, and showed him all the experiences in the universe, all manifestations, bringing him higher and higher through various bodies till his lost glory came back and he remembered his own nature. Then the kind mother went back the same way she came, for others who also have lost their way in the trackless desert of life. And thus is she working, without beginning and without end. And thus, through pleasure and pain, through good and evil, the infinite river of souls is flowing into the ocean of perfection, of self-realization. Glory unto those who have realized their own nature. May their blessings be on us all.